My name is Reed Esau. Recently, on November 12th of 2010, fellow SkeptiCamp organizers and myself participated in a special online event, the first of its kind, called a virtual post-mortem. At this video conference, we discussed the SkeptiCamp events of the past year and what we learned from them. The following is an audio record of this event. Please bear with the choppy audio at the beginning. It improves as the event progresses. Thank you, everyone, for joining us. What exactly is a post-mortem? It's a mechanism for improving something where we look back on the project, or in our case, a whole bunch of events, and we look to see what worked and what didn't work and see if we can come away with some new information to help future events. It's not going to be so much my opinions of what SkeptiCamp is, but rather how things have turned out for all the different events that have happened. So I'm recording this, and Brian is recording this, and it may go up as some audio recording. But the main goal is to get enough information that we can load the wiki with all the different things that we come away with from this meeting.
Did you just say load dicking?
Load the wiki.
I said load the wiki,
which is equally euphemistic.
I was wondering what load dicky meant.
So let's just very briefly start with everyone introducing themselves and describe which event you were involved with and what you're drinking. So okay. I'm Reed Esau. I've organized two of the SkeptiCamp events here in Colorado, and I'm drinking Colorado Native, which is brewed about a quarter mile away from me. Mitch, why don't you go next?
Organized New York City Skeptic last year, doing the same this year. Right now, I wanted to drink some pumpkin spice silk, but I just ran out. This is great stuff, by the way. So I'm drinking cherry limeade instead.
Wow, that is pretty good stuff. Crazy Friday night.
How about Rich Orman?
Well, I'm Rich Orman. I've helped Reed organize Colorado SkeptiCamp, and I have a glass of Aurora tap water, which is supposedly the best water in the state of Colorado. Won a contest.
Okay. I'm Jem Newman. I organized the SkeptiCamp Winnipeg.
How about Jeff Wegg?
I'm here. I organized a whole bunch of TAMs, but they don't really count. However, I did on the last Amazing Adventure do sort of a quasi SkeptiCamp model where I had the participants speak. And actually my new venture, which is SkepTours, I'm doing the same model there too. So it's not exactly the same thing, but it has a lot of the same things in common. So that's where I am. And I was drinking white wine, but it's gone, and I'm very sad.
Okay.
Elise, I hope I pronounced that right.
Elise, yes. I organized SkeptiCamp in Chicago, and I'm sorry, I'm very loud because I have a 3-year-old helping me. I organized SkeptiCamp in Chicago last year in March with Mr. Matt Lowry and that lovely lady who's hugging Jeff Wagg. And I am drinking Rogue Mocha Porter.
Oh, that stuff is awesome.
Yeah, and it's like skeptically themed because it's the Rogues, like SGU.
Yep.
Well, you guys all suck.
Hey, I liked it.
Richard, can we hear you?
What's the profanity level on this? How much can I drop F-bombs? And?
Well, usually I don't give a fuck about language, but...
Oh, fuck yeah.
I have no idea. Do I have audio?
Yep, we hear you now, Richard.
Okay.
Yep.
Apparently I turned it off in Flash when I changed over to Safari. I ran the Toronto SkeptiCamp. I was the sucker who decided to do that one. So
sucker.
Went really well. Bad? So.
And what are you drinking?
Oh, Kraken Spice Rum.
Nice.
Excellent. Matt Lowry.
He's black.
Well, while Matt is working with his audio, how about Tana, a.k.a. Heather?
Tana.
Tana. She's okay. Texan.
I'll stick with Heather.
Otherwise known as Heather. That's a long joke. I helped organize a lot. Well, Brian Gregory was really the big organizer of the Washington, D.C. area Skeptic Camp. I also presented at D.C. Skeptic Camp. And I live in Virginia, actually. Alexandria.
Oh, that works.
I'm drinking water as well.
Oh, I'm so disappointed. Melody.
Not from Aurora, though.
Melody?
I'll try to talk louder.
Yeah, I mean, it's really, so really faint.
I helped organize the last few Skeptic Camps that have been in Vancouver. And right now, I'm sad to say I'm only drinking Diet Coke.
You'll have to unmute yourself, Matt.
How about now?
Yes.
Yeah, that's better.
Go.
There you go.
Blow something up. Never mind.
Oh, should I introduce myself now?
Yes. And what you're drinking.
Mm.
Yes. Matt Lowry. I co-organized the Chicago Skeptic Camp with really awesome, cool people. And as soon as I found out that this is a drinking event, I went downstairs and grabbed some Nosferatu beer, along with some Stone Levitation Ale. I especially like beer. But since I don't like beer, and that was just for show, I'm going to go with this Rock Out wine.
From the bottle. Awesome.
Drinking it hobo style.
And Elise knows that I have a low tolerance for alcohol, but
so we really need to get your microphone working.
But I think he just said he's going to make out with us all in 10 minutes. Oh.
Which means we really need to get his microphone working because he's going to say some funny stuff.
I think we got everybody covered there to move forward. I want to encourage people to talk about things that didn't work. Talk about the screw-ups because those are as valuable as, and perhaps even more valuable than what worked. So I'll start myself by saying that for the last Skeptic Camp, I had designed some shirts, and I had the logo placed too far to the side of the shirt. And so what could have been a really cool shirt is a shirt that's kind of weird.
So that's the worst thing that happened?
Collector's item.
It's memorable. It's memorable.
I'm wearing the shirt of shame.
If you want to see a good Skeptic Camp shirt, that's Brian's got the good Skeptic Camp shirt.
Yeah, the DC, I think, has had the best Skeptic Camp shirt
I'll
yet.
I'll talk like this so I can show off the shirt.
Flaming DC. I don't remember who exactly designed the shirt, but it turned out really well.
Yeah, it's an awesome shirt. I got one.
I like that.
We have a claim that Vancouver had a better shirt, but I doubt it.
I like the blue. So yeah, cool.
See, I like the fact that it has the Capitol and the Washington Monument and stuff in it.
But meanwhile, let's see, who to start with? How about Elise?
Hey.
Would you share?
Okay.
Start on either side of what worked and what didn't work.
Okay. Oh Jesus! It was crazy because we did not expect our camp to be as successful as it was. Starting from the very beginning, I insisted that we were not going to have more than 30 people attending, and we ended up with 80. We didn't have a big enough venue, and the venue thing was just kind of a disaster because we didn't know what we were expecting, and I really don't know how you work around ending up being, you know, more successful than you expected to be. We didn't have a big enough venue, and then we had...
I recall that you had lost your original venue.
We did lose our original venue, and then we got a second venue, which they insisted could hold like 130 people. So I was like, oh, we're expecting, you know, 75 to 80. That should be fine. But they meant that it would hold like 140 people standing, and like if we used the whole room for people standing. And I didn't ask about that. And so we ended up with not enough chairs, not enough room, and it was the chair situation was a disaster, but fortunately the rest of it went over well enough that people were willing to forgive us for that, because it ended up being a 10-hour event. Yeah. We started at noon, and then we were done at 10 o'clock, and not enough chairs was a really big deal. What else? We had a lot of venue problems. The one guy that we put in charge of finding venues in the first place, we probably should have put several people on it. He didn't seem to, like, really grasp the idea of what we were trying to do, and I didn't really step in and say, okay, no, you're really, really wrong. This is what we're looking for. I just kept saying, no, that's not right. And I tried to tell him, but I don't think I did well enough, because he wanted to rent out the merchandise mart. It was going to cost us, like, $10,000. And he wanted to, you know, he was looking for these, like, conventional things, and I don't think I did a good enough job explaining or pairing him up with somebody else that could help him. And then, yeah, that was tough. And then he ended up just getting frustrated, and we picked a different. We as a group decided to pick the place that we'd been planning the events at. Go ahead, Matt.
Yeah. As far as, do you want us to list the things that we did wrong first, or didn't they first?
Well,
yeah,
I just
let's
wanna,
go. So...
Yeah, I want to continue just with the exploring what you might have done differently now that you have the. Retrospective view on it.
Yeah, I would say definitely we kind of posed ourselves on the venue thing. I think another problem that we had was we ended up having a lot of leftover t-shirts. They were really good t-shirts, but we kind of fumbled how, you know, too many advertise and sell them. We ended up getting too many of them, and we couldn't sell them all. The other problem that we've had is on the t-shirt angle, and Elise and I have talked about this, is that if I were to do it again, which I wouldn't a second, I think the t-shirts that we make up should be more generic. They shouldn't be dated so much, because then if you do have leftovers, you can sell them more easily, because I think the t-shirts we have just, you know, the date on there. So I would think that perhaps you would want to do that a little bit different. Yeah.
More generic t-shirts.
Yeah, more generic t-shirts, so that, you know, if you have extras left over, they're a little bit easier to get rid of and pass on.
I have a pile if anybody wants any.
That would be one of the other things. Please, can you think about this? We could try to do different.
Oh, we have a lot of t-shirts left. A lot of t-shirts, and I really don't know what to do with them.
Yeah, and they've got a date on it. That's where we're kind of screwed.
You can send a t-shirt to me.
I'll bring you one.
Anybody, if you want a t-shirt, I'll give you a t-shirt.
Yeah.
I will give you one. Okay, Jeff.
If you have any other things that went wrong, hold on to them. We'll hopefully get to them in a bit. Let's switch over to Melanie.
Reed, I have something that goes wrong. Now I feel cheated.
We'll still... You'll get your chance, Rich.
Are we still doing things that went wrong?
No, Reed has terminated that discussion.
No. We'll deal with
so many things went wrong with Skeptic Camp. We can't deal with all of them.
No, Melanie, give us something that went wrong or something that went right with the Vancouver event.
So we actually really lucked out with our venue. We have people at club that they're involved in some of the clubs at the local university, so they get to book rooms for free. So that was great. We were at those contacts and be able to book a really great room at a university. We were supposed to have to pay like a $50 fee to book it. We ended up not even having to pay that. So it really helps to I think make contacts with people that can give you a free room. Sure. We had a lot of people at the last one, and we couldn't fit all the speakers on, so to try to fit everybody in that wanted to speak at this one. We did this new format where we kept the presentations to only 10 minutes. And we weren't really sure it was going to work out, but it actually worked really great. People fit a lot of content in 10 minutes. And we left room for questions and discussions, and it worked out pretty well.
Did you have discussion time after the talks?
Yeah, we did, like, so a 10-minute presentation, then it was just, like, 10 to 15 minutes of questions and discussion afterwards.
Or was that pretty active, or did you have to, did you need filler, or did you use breaks, or what?
It was really active. It was actually more active than when we had the longer presentations, I think, because when people do a really long presentation, there's, you know, they answer most people's questions, and so when we shortened up the presentations, then there was, you know, people had a lot of questions, or they wanted to start a lot of discussion.
How about, let's see, who's, how about Mitch? You had yours last December.
Yep, that was about a year ago, and we're having another one in a couple of weeks.
See you
so,
there.
Let's see. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Yep, we can hear you.
Okay. I guess the biggest, by the way, I was lucky enough to work with a bunch of, like, world-class event organizers in New York City. They did Nexus and a bunch of other things. New York City Skeptics, great group of folks.
Yes, they are.
So we really had very little that went wrong. I guess the biggest thing that went wrong, the most regrettable thing that went wrong in our Skeptic Camp was the video and the photographs and the general audio quality of recording and stuff like that. That's one of the reasons I haven't been able to get the to edit the videos of all the Skeptic Camp lectures out like I wanted to is because the it was taking a lot longer than it usually does to put together a good quality grouping of video and audio. I had two cameras, but they were both lousy. I was actually doing the video recording myself. That's really the key to all the failures. if I had designated a specific person with at least a little bit of experience, I mean, I have experience videotaping things, but if I had somebody else devoted to doing the video, I'm pretty sure the video would have worked out a lot better. We had one person, we had a couple of folks, I think, trying to work out the audio recording on separate equipment, and for some reason, they were using, like, wireless equipment, wireless mic, and for some reason there was a lot of interference, a lot of stuff, junk, and like that. So the general recording of the whole thing was just not good, but the event itself was very nice. I can go off on minor things.
Oh, Mitch, before you go on, as far as the audio recording goes, did you have you didn't have a backup audio recording? Just had one person using one device.
No, I had audio recording on the cameras that were also recording video, and we did have a separate, we had a wireless mic recording audio to separate equipment. The problem is that the separate device had a lot of interference because of its wireless nature and because things weren't, we didn't have enough time quite to set it up properly. The audio quality did get better as the day went on, but the audio quality on the camera itself is kind of meh, you know. I'm pretty sure Jeff Wagg has some experience with this, with what was it, Tam, what was the one they didn't record the audio on it's like you're relying on audio equipment that was recorded from other things, and it's just
TAM 6, the entirety of TAM 6, they forgot to check the audio feed, and they had a cable plugged into the camera, but the camera had two audio outs, and the one that they had it plugged into was muted for 4 days! 4 days! And nobody checked it. So
I thought only one day.
No. We lost all, they never got anything. So what happened was our DVD guy actually went and got the audience recordings, everyone in the audience who recorded. Wow. Fortunately, Soccer Girl recorded almost the whole thing. And he actually went through and hand-synced other people's audio with the video that we recorded.
That's
and,
a ton of work.
A salvable
wow, that's
DVD.
Amazing.
Oh yeah,
we're doing that too. We're actually sort of doing that too. We're taking audio from one video camera, putting on the better a video of the other one, and stuff like that. That's one of the things that's taken so long. It was only one day you didn't get the audio.
What kind of venue were you at? Sorry, go ahead, Jeff.
Oh, the venue we were at?
Yeah, was it like a...
It was actually like a, what's it called? It's sort of like a dance studio rehearsal-ish kind of a thing. It's a spot. Well, what's going on with this dog?
Don't get distracted.
Anyway.
We're talking, man.
Okay,
the dog
Mitch,
is not a 10 skeptic camp, so yeah. Let's stay on focus.
Yeah. Mitch, we'll come back to you. How about Jim? Jim, what went right or what went wrong?
Oh, we had a bunch of stuff go on. First off, I mean, the team of organizers and presenters were exceptionally helpful in ensuring that everything was set up. We had a really great team, so it wasn't just me. And in fact, most of it wasn't me. We had Scott Carnegie, one of the members of the Winnipeg Skeptics and the Humanist Association of Manitoba. He not only did he turn in some excellent presentations, he did a lot of work for video for us, and he put together that promo that some of you may have seen, and he also did all of the filming and actually inserted the PowerPoint slides into that some of the presenters were using into the actual video presentation as well, so they're nice and clear, and so that's great. There are no real technical hiccups, and we had some great positive feedback. People were mentioning shirts, and they had way too many shirts left over. We did shirts too, which we have right
cool.
there, the Confusion Corner logo. We actually did them via Zazzle. If you wanted one, you had to order it online beforehand, or you could order it after. And we had, you know, half a dozen people show up with them, which is fine. But there were no extras, right? So that was good. We did have four presenters drop out about 48 hours right before the event. Luckily, we had some additional presentations in sort of our back pockets. So both
what,
Scott and
Jim, I... Jim, what were the... what were the reasons? What were the reasons for those people dropping out?
Sure. The reasons that I was given was usually they ran out of time doing their prep, or one of the people was unable to make it entirely. There's a family thing that went on, so there's sort of nothing we can do about that. But the other three, it was just they ran out of time to prep. We had a prep meeting about 3.5 weeks before the Skeptic Camp, and everything seemed like it was on track, but not quite sure what we could have done to prevent that, but we're open to suggestions.
Yeah, we've actually seen that at some of our events in Colorado where people bail out of doing the talk either because of cold feet or because they didn't finish their prep or because something came at the last second. And obviously, where something comes up, like a family thing, you can't do anything about that. Right. As far as the prep goes, anybody have any suggestions about how to make that work better?
Well, Elise, didn't we have one of our speakers? Didn't we have one of our speakers drop out and we got a replacement?
We actually lost a few speakers. But we had 20 speakers. So, but what we had was a reserve list. So we were able to call people in and fill the spots. And we also kind of scheduled our day so that it was crazy, crazy packed, assuming that people were going to drop out.
Yeah. So what happened is because we had some inevitable drops, that gave us. A little more leeway to work with. Plus, what we did is that as the day went on, if we knew that someone could make it, one of us would run through the speakers that were going to be, you know, on later in the day, and you know, we would tell them, look, you know, you can have an extra 5 minutes for your talks if you may or whatever. That's worked out really well. We found that by not making it really rigid and allowing for a little bit of allowing for it to flow a little more freely, it really made things a lot.
Anybody else have any experience with people dropping out?
We had a couple of speakers that signed up that didn't actually do talks, but we were overbooked. We had a certain amount of time, and we had extra speakers that were kind. I mean, we had a couple of speakers that were like they weren't sure they wanted to do the talks anyway. So it kind of we worked it out at the end. And plus Bruce, we had an excellent guy, Bruce Press, who was very good about keeping the time on schedule and kind of ran with it and did breaks at the right time and did everything kind of on the fly. So flexibility.
Well, I mean, one person dropped out. I guess she got sick that morning and she didn't show up. So I kind of was she the so we only have one person drop out or we have two people drop out?
There were two, but who got sick and couldn't come?
That was
Oh yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
We knew that ahead of time, though. We kind of planned for it, yeah.
But it gave us some extra cushion time, which is nice, since we didn't plan in a lunch period.
Yeah, which was probably the biggest mistake we made. We had a Sunday venue, which we couldn't even get in the room until 11 a.m. And plus, we needed an hour to set up. So we started right at noon, and we had no lunch break. So people were, like, running down during the 10-minute breaks to get food and come back. And that was probably the biggest mistake we made.
Well, I have some suggestions for missing speakers because it's something I've dealt with a lot. What I have done is I have the organizers, which usually involve me, always have a talk in the can. That's so if you know, if you need to, you can always go on and do something. Also, I always have a bunch of videos with me. I have videos that can fill 10 minutes that are on topic, and it's the worst case scenario is, and now for something different. We're going to show this video from a grassroots skeptic who created this project, blah, 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 blah.
That's a good idea.
That kind of thing.
Yep. One of the other things that I saw from Chicago or from Skeptic Camp was that you guys were heavily promoting the talks beforehand, essentially setting expectations for all the speakers that their people are going to be anticipating what they're going to be presenting and thus deter them from bailing out when they've advertised that they want to do a talk.
Yeah, I don't know if we were thinking along those lines when we set it up that way, but
yes, we were. Shh.
We were.
Totally, we were.
Yeah.
That was my plan.
That's awesome, by the way.
Sorry. Yeah, but
no, but what happened? One thing that was negative about that was that you know we had Debbie Goddard was actually going to come in from New York and do a talk, and she ended up breaking her leg and she couldn't make it, and she was going to like drive from Buffalo with a broken leg, and I'm like, don't do that.
Yeah, people understand.
And I actually had to talk her out of coming, but I had somebody who showed up just to see her talk. And was really upset because they weren't able to see the diversity in skepticism talk.
Yeah, but they got to see me with my shirt off, so that's okay.
That was not why she came,
okay.
Matt.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Okay.
We should have actually. Oh, go ahead.
Okay. Any other comments about what we can do to deter people from bailing when they can avoid bailing?
Well, we actually were very flexible about that because we partnered with a college group, and we kind of knew that some of them would be really into doing the talk, and some of them would be kind of tenuous about it. So we tried to remain flexible, and that was kind of the big thing. So
the reason why I think this is a very interesting question is some of the best Skeptic Camp talks that I've seen have been from people who have been reluctant to do the talk in the first place. And so the more that we can avoid people or giving people excuses to bail, the better and more diverse talks that we're going to see.
I'm going to say that Dr. Jen was looking for every single excuse to not give a talk. And like any time there was like a conflict or a time, she's like, I won't do my talk. Don't worry about it. I won't do it. I'm like, no, you're doing your talk. And It was fantastic, and I totally agree with you, Reed. It was one of the best talks of the day.
Yep. Confirmation bias.
There you go.
Rich Orman. What went right or what went wrong?
I went wrong.
Yeah. What went right or what went wrong with Colorado's recent event?
Yeah, Reed turned over all the planning to some college students. Callow youths. Who then proceeded to do nothing. And then we had to take over.
What college?
I won't mention it.
Come on. Because we partnered with the University of Maryland, and then they kicked ass. I mean, our venue was thanks to the University of Maryland guys. So.
Well, actually, we ended up doing it at CU Boulder, and they ended up giving us a room, and they were fantastic. But some of the youngsters maybe just think they're going to take it on and end up not doing it.
Yeah, that's why you have to come.
And maybe we're running into that again. I'm not sure.
Yeah, to tell you
the
truth.
But not necessarily.
With our event, I didn't do anything.
And also, I should say, Reed hitting on all the female speakers was a big – that was a big problem.
Yeah.
I mean, Reed thought it was his own personal dating service. And
– well, there is that aspect. I mean, if you're a legal organizer,
lost about 10
there a benefit
that
somewhere?
Way.
I mean, come on.
Well, Rich has found out my angle for Skepticamp.
The whole reason for Skepticamp.
That's right.
Okay,
that's right.
So Rich, you can I think for any of these events you can get in fact we've seen non-college students try to organize these events and they've ultimately fallen short for one reason or another and they didn't happen. So I don't know if it's necessarily college students.
Possibly, Reed. Possibly. Also, I agree with what Mitch said about the audio on the streaming. I mean, not many people are watching the streaming, but if it takes quite a setup to get the audio right. WAG knows how to do it. WAG can get it done. But you have to have a separate microphone hooked in, dedicated, going out. Now, WAG is shaking his hands.
Because it's just fun. So there's this dude named Geeky Atheist who donated this to me because he's nice. This is an H2. A Zoom H2, you guys seen this thing?
Yeah, it's nice.
I love this thing, and I'm not actually using it at
Is that where you're using it at Carl Sagan Day?
No. See, this is the funny thing. I thought I was, but it turns out that I was actually just using the you're going to stream your event on Ustream Pro here. So, but anyway, I wanted to tell you about a couple of tools that'll help you out. If you're going to stream your event on Ustream, they just released this new thing called Ustream Producer. It's free. Huh. It had been around on PCs for a while, but they just released it for Macs. Use it because it doesn't use a web browser. It's a separate app that will broadcast for you. It does some switching. It lets you use different sources. It's a little confusing, but it's worth the time. And it's also a lot more stable. I find that with Ustream, it tends to crash over time. So that's a good tip. The other thing is get this cam twist thing. I've been screwing with this for a while. It does all kinds of effects. It lets you put up text. You can just, I mean, it's, a lot of the stuff is stupid. Cam twist. Here, I'll type it.
Cam twist.
Yeah. So, and while you see all this stupid stuff,
thing?
And I was playing with, no, I think it works on PCs too, but I'm not sure. It might be. I just typed that URL in. I made that up. That might not be right. I don't know. You know, I'm a stranger. Why are you clicking on my URLs?
Yeah.
But anyway, Cam Twist is a very helpful tool, and it shows you. It gives you tons of control. Like, you know, all right, so that stuff is silly, but like here, like this is the brightness control, right? So I can do all kinds of stuff like this with this tool. And
were you watching on Skepticamp DC?
I watched a little. I don't think.
How was the audio?
I don't remember. I'm sorry. If I could hear it, was fine.
Okay, because it was just a laptop with a webcam on the top of it. But the biggest regret I had is I kind of watched the back of someone sitting in the chair the whole time.
I watched it. I would say the audio was so-so.
Okay.
They tend to work okay. It's the big thing is testing. Do a lot of testing. My God, try it out. You don't know what the room's gonna do and.
It was one of those things that because we had access to the Wi-Fi at the college, thanks to Chip Denman. He gave us a dedicated Wi-Fi account. It was one of those things. I just like, I'll bring my laptop, I'll set it up. If it works, it works. If it doesn't, it doesn't. It's no big deal. It's not on the critical path for the event. So
okay, that's my other thing. So I know what you're talking about. I did watch that, and there was a guy on there that just infuriated me.
Oh yeah,
but I couldn't respond to him because it kept breaking up for me.
Was it Alex?
I know who he's talking about.
It was the It was the super pro-atheist guy. I don't know.
Oh, it was,
the,
it was Kevin Slaughter.
The giant A on his shirt. You're like, hey, you know, whatever. Was it a personal issue? Doesn't matter. The content's not... The... Hello? Okay,
yeah, we
hello
had
some
controversial speakers.
mute. Yeah. The content's not the issue, but I felt like I couldn't respond to him because I didn't hear what he said well enough.
Oh.
So if at all possible, and this is not always possible, avoid Wi-Fi.
Yeah.
It's better to have a hard connection. The best streaming I've ever seen was from TAM 7. Now, I didn't have much to do with that. That was all Rich Montalvo. But the way we did it was we had a dedicated line, and it fed into a huge mixing board. And we had a direct feed from the cameras and direct audio. We had everything you could want because we had a budget.
Yeah.
You know, Skepticamp doesn't really have that. But you can try to approach that as much as possible. So
We were lucky enough to have a guy who actually knows how to do video. So we had a good video stream. We actually have a plan for next year to get a feed off of that camera.
Excellent.
But and we'll probably get one of the high speed cell services instead of using the college Wi-Fi.
Well, all right. So remember DragonCon?
Yeah.
Who watched DragonCon this year?
Well, I was there.
They tested it. They tested it and it worked fine until the day of the event, and it collapsed because so many people were using that network.
Yeah, like so DC for the rally, that cell networks collapsed because there's so many.
Right,
cell phones.
And this happened at TAM 8 where we had credit card machines for buying books, and they used the same network that text messages go over. So when do people buy books? At the breaks. When do people send text messages? At the breaks. Our machines went down. So you know you have these things you can't think of. So if possible, get a hard wire, and I know it's not going to be possible very often.
It depends on the venue.
Let's put the video aside for right now. I want to return briefly to Rich Orman's point about the first set of organizers for our event falling through. Does anyone here, obviously here we have all successful events that went forward. We don't have a representation of the events that didn't go forward. But have any of you encountered any problems with other organizers not coming through with doing things and how you address that situation?
We were blessed. I mean, we had a fantastic group, so I don't even know. I have no idea what kind of advice to give you for that because our group was
rock solid. Same here.
Rock solid.
I think one of the things that worked really well, because Elise said that we were blessed with a really great, you know, group of folks. I think something that really made that work was the fact that our core group of organizers, we really bonded as a group. Because we had regular face-to-face meetings, and I think having that kind of group bonding really kind of upped the expectation that, you know, you're really a part of something here, and so when you're given a job, you've got to follow through. You know, it wasn't just people, you know, talking online, though ironically I was talking online for the meetings. The joke was nobody knew what I looked like and I only existed virtually. But once we actually
only existed in my laptop.
Yeah. Once we were having regular face-to-face meetings where we were all there, it really kind of solidified the idea that, you know, this is a real thing, you're really expected to do this. And not to mention, you know, we found out where each other lived so we could go break legs if we needed to.
But we also, we weren't just communicating at the meetings. We had an email list,
right.
And
yeah. Right.
We were communicating all the time. I mean, they were so sick of me by the end of the second week of planning, and we planned for like 6 months, because I would just send like tons of emails.
Yeah.
And not only that, but if people couldn't make it to a face-to-face meeting, they would Skype in.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, we really set that bar high, I think. And I think that helps.
How about, did anybody have any communications problems as far as organizers being not communicative or not Well, not only not coming through, but just not responding to email, etc.
You know, we actually did have a problem with our guy that was originally in charge of finding the venues. He wasn't responding to his emails. He wasn't, you know, like I said, he wasn't getting the message, but he wasn't responding to emails. I didn't have his number. I wasn't going to call him, but he wasn't finding the venues, and nobody could get in touch with him. And you know, I think that if we were to do that again, and we had somebody who was not getting the message, by the second meeting, if this is, you know, still going on,
yeah,
we'd probably reassign it. Because we ended up going like 3 or 4 meetings, and this guy was still like, well, we could get the merchandise mart for $10,000.
I remember.
Elise, was a person showing up at the meetings?
Yes, he was showing up at the meetings, but like he would only touch base at the meetings and nobody else knew what was going on. Yeah. And then once we actually ended up booking a place that he didn't like, and he was like always trying to change the format and like all kinds of crap, but like finally we were just like, all right, we're just going to go with this place. He stopped showing up. So
yeah, we dumped him, or he dumped us, but that was okay.
It was okay with us. It wasn't what he wanted to do. He wanted to do something different.
Yeah. Well, that's an interesting point.
And I think that thing was date Dr. Jen.
I remember when we were first talking about doing a skeptic camp here in D.C., I actually talked to her on Skype to get some ideas about what to do and how to go through stuff. And she told me the story, and it helped because we actually had the person I originally delegated to do the speaker wrangling. Something happen in her life, and she hadn't had time to do it, and I actually had to step in, ping her repeatedly when stuff wasn't getting done, and then eventually later, actually it was a group activity. It was me, Bruce, and a couple other people that got involved to do the speaker wrangling. So it's just a matter of paying attention and jumping in and getting everybody to take up the slack. So. Did you have someone else you assigned that job to, or did you end up taking it over yourself?
You mean the speaker wrangling?
No,
it was the venue.
Venue.
Yeah, was it for you guys? It was the venue.
The venue.
You know, we put a couple people on it, and we actually just ended up the first time around. We ended up just booking the place that we had been doing our planning meetings at, and it was kind of just a group consensus. And I mean,
then it
what,
went
one
to
thing,
hell.
And I,
yeah.
But what Jeff is saying in the comments is one thing that was huge for us was that the, you know, on the Skeptic Camp wiki, it says that the person, you know, handling everything doesn't handle you. You have one job and it's to oversee everything.
Yes.
You don't take on other jobs.
Exactly.
That was so huge. I did not take on extra responsibilities, and I was, you know, like, oh, I feel like such a slacker. I'm such an asshole, and I'm doing this. I'm taking it so easy, and I ended up doing a lot of work because I had to do. In my job and doing nothing was to do everything, and it was huge that I didn't take on any extra jobs because. When our venue fell through, what was it, like 3-4 weeks before Skeptic Camp happened?
It was we had the time date set, we had all the speakers set, everything, and then one like 3 or 4 weeks beforehand, our venue craps out, and we're just like, I mean, it was
I was able to just, you know, drop everything and just because 100% on finding us a new place, and I found a place within a week. But if I had all these other jobs, I wouldn't have been able to do that.
That was huge,
and I highly recommend that whoever's in charge do not have other responsibilities. Because one thing somebody else told me was like, you know, you can't do that. You're dealing with volunteers, and volunteers, you're getting what you pay for, and you're going to have to take on, you know, do it yourself. It's just easier. And if I did that,
no way.
Let's,
yeah, you always, Murphy's Law, you always got to count on something's going to fuck up. And you got to have somebody who's got the time to deal with that shit.
Let's move on to the next topic or next person. Richard, if you could unmute and let us tell us what worked or what didn't work with Toronto's first Skeptic Camp event.
actually, we were really, really lucky. I had a good group of people who we didn't have enough stuff to do, is what it turned out. I had Carl Mamer was doing the wrangling of speakers. We had two guys looking for venues, and they found one pretty much immediately. They had three good options, and we went with CFI because CFI was fantastic. We had PA, we had audiovisual, we had everything was covered. We had way too many speakers, so we packed the schedule. Then we had two people drop out. One drop out, and then one changed his schedule. He had to do a different talk because he was just too busy to do a new talk. So we only lost one guy. We didn't do anything fancy. We had no banners. We had no T-shirts. We had no budget, of course, except for what we were paying out of our pockets, like everyone. And we packed everything into 5 hours, and then we went for beer. It worked. The only problem was my problem, and it was the fact that I can't keep time. I need to delegate timekeeping to someone else. Because I let one guy who was interesting go on and on and on, because we had time to kill.
Well, if the person is interesting, it's certainly a good idea to let them go on.
We had a couple nuts show up at the end, but that was another story.
Yeah, we actually had one discussion we had to cut off.
Bouncers.
So.
But we took a collection.
What's that, Brian?
We had a discussion. There was one
controversial
talk. We had to,
interesting,
we had to
crazy. Yeah.
Well, the way
has anybody else
timer.
Had a problem? That raises a good question. Who's had speakers that you've had to cut off for reasons of content?
Oh, we didn't have any crazy speakers.
We didn't really have a problem.
We had
so
controversial
with that.
Speakers, but that's it.
I have cut off speakers many
we
times.
We had one guy who riled up the audience and basically, you know, it was like a free-for-all. People just started...
Was it torch and pitchfork time?
Yeah, basically.
It was getting pretty close.
Ooh, cool.
I think
what
someone,
was the topic?
I think someone made a comment in the chat room on the stream.
He was basically... the topic was... I guess he was really critical of the secular. He's a conservative atheist, and he was really critical of sort of the secular left, but he didn't really have the facts to back up what he was saying.
Yeah, that was the main.
Which
point.
I mean, that was fun. It was an interesting thing to bring up because we don't hear about that enough. You know, sort of. Right secularists, but he just really didn't seem to have. If you're going to make that argument with a bunch of people who tend to be sort of left leaning, you really need to have the stuff to back that argument up. So,
Tana, was there any interaction with the person during his presentation?
A number of us were going to ask questions because while he was giving his talk, I was like, I'm going to raise my hand, but I'm going to let him finish. And a lot of us were just going to wait because we knew we were going to have time discussing afterwards, let him finish his prepared talk, and then all hell broke loose. So,
there was whispering within the audience before he stopped, but as soon as he stopped, it was like, I have to get you on whatever it was. So
I had to tell the audience to shut up once. We had a guy who was basically espousing the teabag philosophy, the Tea Party philosophy, whatever the hell the name of that ersatz
teabag
group is.
Is close enough.
Yeah.
To me.
And in the middle of the way we were doing the talk was you'd give your talk and you would look, it's the drink fairy. Oh, thank you, drink fairy.
I want a drink fairy too.
No. Yeah. Sorry. Drink? This one's mine.
Oh.
Thank you.
He got the food.
Okay. Everybody has to drink. Everybody has to drink. Yeah. Come on. Let's go to the drink fairy.
We're halfway done, so drink up.
All right. So very quickly, I feel like in this event, I was acting as the MC, so I felt like my job was to protect the speakers. I don't have to agree with what they're saying. It doesn't matter. But they need the respect to be able to – they've taken the courage to get up there and say what they're going to say. They get their 10 minutes. That's it. Now, this is my personal take on this. The audience was being disrespectful, so I got up and said, shut up! A little bit differently than that, but not terribly differently from that, because that's how I saw my role. This guy can take his heat in the Q&A session not during his talk.
Wait, was that on the cruise, or was that at a TAM event? That was at
That was on the cruise.
Okay.
And there are a couple people who are here that might actually know what I'm talking about, but they got into it. It went off into this tangent, this discussion about gay bashing, which wasn't even the topic. Well, hello there.
So, sorry.
Nicely done.
Sorry.
Anyway,
sorry.
You shut up.
My point is that someone has to protect the speakers. They're on stage. They have the right to say what they're going to say. And then once Q&A is open, the dynamic shifts a bit because the audience has the right.
Jeff, that raises a very interesting point, because at Skeptic Camp events, these are basically open events that are not curated. In the case of the cruise, you did curate the talks, from what I understand. Mm-hmm. And so you had some idea what was going to be said.
Well, actually, no. When you got to me, I was telling you I screwed up on. And one of the things I screwed up on was that I didn't really curate the talks as far as, like, hey, here's so-and-so, this is what their talk is about. I just said, here's so-and-so. I didn't know what the hell their talk was about. That was a mistake that I made. But I was going to protect their space up there. And if Skeptic Camp's... Hi, Maria!
Hey!
If there's no MC or some speaker's space, what's going to happen when someone comes up and says something like, you know, I think homosexuality is a mental illness and I have the facts to prove it, and then people are throwing chairs at them.
Shit.
You know, what's going to happen then?
Wow.
Because eventually something like that's going to happen. So I'm just saying that I think it's a good idea at these events to have someone who's like the MC.
Yeah. Well, we had a really good guy who, Bruce is really good at keeping people in line, but another thing that we kind of did behind the scenes, I know you're not really supposed to vet the speakers, but we did kind of like look over the topics and make sure there wasn't anything that was too nuts. We didn't have anything, but we were like, you know, we've got only a certain amount of time.
Brian, you had a Satanist preacher.
I know. Tell me about it. I know the guy. The guy's actually pretty cool, actually, but... But I mean, because we had CFI involved, so of course we're going to get some of the, you know, the really secular kind of oddballs. But I was a little concerned about that talk, but Bruce kind of, because he knew Kevin. We kind of know Kevin from Drinking Skeptically, so it went very well, actually. I enjoyed the preaching.
I have to say that I thought, even with our more controversial speakers, I thought DC's audience was, you know, very well behaved in general.
That's true.
There didn't seem, most people were respectful of the speaker, even if they were like completely vehemently against him.
At the Colorado events, we've at our last one, we had a global warming skeptic speaker. And we had him in our main room, and it was more a discussion than him lecturing to us for 15, 20 minutes. And I fear that if it wasn't interactive, if we were to basically give him his 10, 15, 20 minutes, that it would have just been nonstop misinformation.
Yeah, one thing that we did is we actually kind of vetted our speakers. I mean, we had a setup where, you know, we actually had a web page where once we had found a speaker who was going to talk about something specific and they committed, we said, okay, here's what they're going to talk about, and we put it up on this website, and we were like telling people about it. So it's like, hey, this is what you're going to get if you come to Skeptic Camp. And we even had little flyers and brochures that we were handing out at Skeptic Camp saying, okay, at, you know, 1:45, so-and-so is going to speak on this topic. So we kind of did completely the opposite. We had it all planned out ahead of time with, you know, minor shuffling if somebody had to drop out. We had a last-minute substitution or something like that. So people who came to Skeptic Camp knew what they were getting. And so
did you have to turn anybody away?
Elise, do you remember if we had to turn anyone away from Skeptic Camp as a speaker?
Okay, I had to go take care of a child. Are we talking about turning them away, like, because we were too full, or turning them away because they were jerks?
Anything. I don't remember us turning anyone away because they were a jerk, but I can't remember if we dropped anyone. No, we did drop some people because we had
we were full speakers.
Once we reached 20,
we were at 20 speakers, and then we started a waiting list. Like, my husband wasn't able to give a talk.
Yeah.
And Dr. Jen offered to step down, and I said no.
Yeah. One of the things that we did is we basically said,
okay,
here's the list of people who have said that they're interested in giving a talk, and we basically got all of their emails, and we contacted them and said, okay, you need to tell us specifically what you want to talk about and give us this information by this date. And if we haven't received that information from you by that date, you get bumped to the bottom of the list, and when it comes time to kick people off because we have too many speakers, you're going to go first. And we made that very clear. Right. We actually did end up dropping some people because they just didn't get their crap to us on time.
I don't know if we did. We did drop
a couple of people that way, I think.
Because, you know, we were actually overbooked.
Right.
And, it ended up working out fine. But we gave priority, since we were skeptic camp, you know, women got first choice at time slots, and then men got choices based on whether or not they had their talks decided.
Right. And, yeah, that's what I meant.
And when they said they were going to do their talk, or like when they signed up to do their talk. So, if you were the first guy.
Sorry, go ahead.
I was going to say
about multiple rooms, yeah. That's been Reed's idea for the past couple of years, and I found that we had multiple rooms this year, and it really worked well. We had it last year, too, two simultaneous things going on, and I think the first time we did it, we were chock full of speakers for both times. I think we had about 70% with the second room, and, I mean, I was the MC in room number one, and I missed a lot of stuff in the second room. But everybody that wanted to speak had time, and there were some people that wanted to go over their allotted time, and we just said, if you want to hear what this guy has to say, just follow him into room number two, and we'll give him as much time as he needs there. And I think that everybody then that wanted to talk got to talk. There was a time or two where we had to sort of shuffle people from one room into the other so someone wasn't speaking to an empty room, sort of, you know, do that.
Hey, did anybody else here have two rooms? I think it was Colorado.
No, we did 2 days instead of splitting up rooms. So that was our solution for getting as many speakers as we could, because we did it over a whole weekend.
I think that's amazing that she just jumped on the camera and her mic works right off the bat.
She is amazing.
She's just that cool.
There is nothing Maria can't do. Nothing.
So for those events with a large schedule, or with a lot of speakers, two rooms or 2 days, or have like Vancouver, if Melanie's still there, have two events in a year.
Yeah, we're actually trying to plan our next meeting. Because we want to start planning early because we only started promoting our events maybe a month and a half ahead of time. We put it off and put it off. And we're like, well, you know, it's going to be just us guys from, you know, the local group, CFI and NCAS and all these local groups. It's just going to be us, and it's not going to be that big a deal. We're lucky if we get 60 people. We were full after doing maybe a month of promotion, a month and a half out. So, I mean, next year we've got a plan for something bigger, and either two rooms or maybe, I don't know, a bigger room. Or, I mean, the problem with two rooms is you have to have resources for those rooms. You have to have someone to manage the computers. You have to have someone to MC. If you want a video, you've got all these other issues. So,
yeah, that's kind of my concern.
Can you guys hear me now? Sorry.
Oh yeah. You're much louder now. That's Melanie.
Oh, that's good. Okay.
Yeah.
Yep.
Sorry, Marie was talking. Go.
Oh, no, that's okay. I was just saying that for us, you know, for AV concerns, as well as I just hate missing stuff, right? So yeah. I hate not being able to go to everything. So that's kind of why we went with the 2 days instead. And we filled it very well and managed to, managed to get good attendance on both days. So I think for us, that's kind of the better solution.
Well, Maria, while we have you, what for Atlanta's second event, what worked and what didn't?
Everything worked fine. There was nothing wrong.
I knew she was going to say that.
We don't make mistakes in Atlanta.
Clearly.
You're just overrun by zombies.
No, what worked well was we just knew things a little better the second year around. We were able to plan a little better. The two things that kind of didn't work out well for us was, one was the venue, which was a great venue. It was actually Derek Colanduno got us a space in his office building, and it was perfect. And there were two big problems. One was it was a secure location, so we had to keep running up and down with the badge because it was off hours. So when people showed up, we had to put a sign up on the door that said, call this phone number and get people upstairs. And that was a bit of a pain.
Wow.
And then the other problem was that, which nobody could have ever foreseen, was that it was, they decided they were doing some construction and they turned the air conditioning off. So it was, and it was in the middle of the summer, so it was hotter than hell both days. And so that was a bit of an issue. And then the other thing that didn't work out so well for us was we had this idea of kind of having a couple of sessions of what we called poster presentations, which was right in the morning, where we would, you know, people who didn't want to necessarily do a full talk or who we couldn't slot in for a full talk, we had a couple hours where people could kind of put up sort of like science fair poster presentations. And we had a couple of people do that. We had a ton of people sign up to do that, but not that many people actually did it. So that didn't work out as well. I think the concept was really solid. I think the problem was that we didn't give enough detail and we didn't prep enough for that and give people enough kind of information about how to do that.
I might have some comments on the topic of poster presentations if you want to hear them.
Sure.
Go.
All right. I just wish I could remember what they were. I also got the idea of doing poster presentation-like stuff for Skeptic Camp New York City this year. And so far, I think we got like one poster idea submitted. So that might be it. But if you want to do the posters properly, I guess you should probably plan for them in advance. You should have I'm trying to remember what some of the advice was that this friend of mine named Danny gave me. Ideas for having during the poster presentations have contests, I guess, about like which is the best poster and stuff like that, and have a couple of prizes associated with that. I do have a page for poster presentation related stuff on the Skeptic Camp New York City website. Maybe that'll give me some. Maybe that'll help me remember.
Yeah, I think our problem was very much that we should have just put in a few guidelines around what the poster presentation, what we kind of expected from our poster presentations, and what you know, what the format of that would be.
Well, if you go to
that would be one of my questions. Is what? Oh, go ahead, Mitch.
If you go to skepticcampnyc.org/posters.aspx, I'll copy this into the chat room for you. You'll see basically the outline of what our guidelines and rules were, and there's a very nice link to a poster design PDF from someone's from Cornell University that I like, and so that might help you. Help establish some ideas.
Okay, but I want to leave that topic down. We have about 40 minutes to go, and I'd like to try to get through one more round of what went right, what went wrong, starting with Melanie. Are you still there, Melanie?
Yep, I'm here.
The disembodied voice.
So maybe one thing that I can bring up that went wrong was sort of the diversity of speakers. We had a good selection of topics, but our speakers were sort of 99% white dudes. And I really, you know, I kind of was in my look at the speaker roster and realized there was one woman on it, and I hadn't noticed the whole time that I, you know, was handling the registrations and stuff. So if anybody has any suggestions on how to improve that, I'd really like to hear them.
Elise, SkepticCamp, tell us how we can deal with that.
One is to name your event SkepticCamp. and promote it on Skeptic and encourage women to participate.
Did I miss something?
Yeah, Jeff punked me. He punked me bad. You bastard!
What did I miss?
So,
I'll tell you the story later. It's a long and sordid and disgusting tale.
I want to hear it.
Continue.
Don't make us take you out of the meeting, Jeff.
I'm having to say, once Reed is done with his chat, the chat's going to stay open, and people are going to can hang out and do all kinds of crazy things. I'm going to be here, so you better tell me the story.
Yeah, I'll tell you the story. Ooh, but let's keep going. Let's keep going.
How many of...
How many other people here have problems
with diverse speakers? How many people had all white male speakers?
We had a few women, but they were women.
We actually weren't too bad. We had quite a few women, but
yeah.
He was white, I think.
Who's talking? Yeah. Yeah. Is that Rich? Who's talking so low?
It's Jim.
At Winnipeg. In Winnipeg, we were pretty good in terms of male to female. We had, I think, 40-60 female to male. Yeah, Canada's internet sucks, Maria. So that was good. We weren't all white in the audience, but I think all of the presenters were white. That's the demographic of the group, more or less. And I think that if I'm not mistaken, that's sort of the way the skeptical movement looks right now. It's getting better though.
At the very first Skeptic Camp, we had almost half women speakers. At our subsequent events, the speakers were mostly dominated by men. Anybody else can relate their experiences there?
I have to admit I kind of sought out a few people. Like Nicole Gallucci and Sharon and some other people that were
keep
local.
Waiting for.
We had four women, I think, out of 10. One of whom, an African American woman, she was the one who was sick and wasn't able to come. But so four women out of 10, not bad.
Yeah, I have to say that sadly, being Skeptic Camp. I think including all the skeptics that traveled in, we were still only at 50%.
Yeah. Yeah.
So and honestly, I think that is huge. I mean, hopefully, as we've done more events as a group. Since then, we've had a bigger showing of women, and women are definitely coming out more for our events. But yeah, having 50-50 at Skeptic Camp was not what I had hoped for.
What will you do differently next time?
I'm definitely going to make sure that we are reaching out to women more, and that the topics are either presented by women or are specifically targeted towards women. When you give us your speech, whatever you want to talk about, how does it relate to women? And how is that important? And I think that you know, that'll help us. And I know that's not necessarily an option for, you know, an all-encompassing type skeptic camp, and ours is definitely more targeted. So, I mean,
Do you think the format itself might be more intimidating to female speakers?
You know, I don't think so. I really don't think so. Perhaps the audience, but I don't know. I don't think it is.
Just one comment on the all white old guys on the stage thing. You know, having organized TAM for years, we got that criticism a lot. And one of the problems we had is that we couldn't get women to speak. Most men we invited would come up, but there was a year, TAM 7, I think, that we invited 8 women, and 6 of them said no outright, and then one of them canceled at the last minute, and we were left with 1.
You know, we actually, one of our women speakers, we had a husband and wife who were both planning on talking, and their kids got sick, and she decided that she was going to stay home, and she sent her husband to talk.
Right. Yeah.
And
which was backwards.
I was actually making fun of him because I'm like, how does that work? How does the husband come to Skeptic Camp to talk while the wife stays at home with the kids? And yeah, one thing we really wanted to do that we couldn't do, and you know, unfortunately this actually became an issue, was we wanted to do a daycare because we think that.
Yes.
Yeah. Kids are a huge thing where, you know, when there's something going on, women are more likely to be stuck with the kids for the day than the husband.
I think Ohio did that.
Yeah.
Ohio did
at the same time.
Yeah, so, you know, that's something we still wanted to deal with, but last year we weren't able to make that happen. And it was one of my big priorities when we started out with the project, and it was just... Right. Something we couldn't pull off. Because I said, you know, in our first meeting that it would be a real tragedy if there was a woman that couldn't attend Skeptic Camp because she had to take care of her kids. So, you know, we'll see what we can do next year.
It's just, there's a phenomenon there.
It's really a tough thing.
Where women
and other than making me
speak.
Not swear and making it, you know, safe for kids.
I think you're right, Jeff. I think women are more reluctant to speak. I don't know why that is, but it's definitely a trend I've seen within our group. Because our skeptic group, men and women-wise, is pretty good. Like, our skeptics in the camp group has a lot of women. Our organizing group had a lot of women. Came down to speakers. We couldn't convince women to do it.
And maybe that's... Actually, I'll full... disclosure here, I didn't like the idea of Skeptic Camp because to me it was excluding half of the population, and I don't think we're in a position to be excluding anyone at this point. But given that we have this phenomenon where women are less likely to speak, maybe the way to overcome that is to make more comfortable places for them to speak. But I don't think I'm the right person for that.
You could argue that this is not so much a problem of open events in particular, but a problem of skepticism generally. It may not be that Skeptic Camp or open events are going to solve this problem, but it's one of the places where we can experiment with different ways of attracting the diversity of speakers.
Yeah, I mean, I think that I think it would be great if, you know, as we get more and more Skeptic Camps going, you know, we try a variety of formats. We try reaching out to a variety of different demographics and whatnot and see, you know, see what works, what doesn't work, because we are in a way pretty much experimenting with this whole process.
Okay, let's leave that topic there. Let's go, how about Richard? Richard. Richard, unmute and...
Hey.
There you go. What worked or what didn't work with Toronto's event?
Everything worked except for timekeeping. We did have one issue with the all-white crew, the all-white guys. We did have one non-white guy. So we had guys, but one was non-white. So that we had a penetration there in the white audience, in the white speakers. We had organizers who were female who didn't want to speak. We just need to advertise more, I think, in the target audience, I guess.
Do you think you're going to dedicate an organizer to next time just to lobby for speakers? I guess you had Carl Mamer this time.
Sorry?
This time you had Carl, yeah, doing your speaker wrangling. Do you think you're going to get more people on that to, let's say, get more female speakers?
The thing that we had is we didn't need a speaker wrangler to actually get speakers to sign up. We had no problem. We had to stop accepting speakers at a point, and all the speakers we had come forward were excellent. We couldn't turn any of them away just because they were guys. They were excellent speakers and great talks. So,
hope you're breaking up there, Richard. At least for me.
We could be no based on what I've had to have made. Yeah, my 28.8, hang on. I'll speak slower.
Just speak Canadian.
We speak in metric, and it just doesn't go across the border that well. I lost where I was anyway.
Okay, let's switch to Wag. Jeff Wag. We haven't asked Jeff what went right, what went wrong with the talks in the cruise.
Well, very quickly, Hal Bidlack taught me a long time ago that flexibility is the key to air power. So I use that to my advantage.
Awesome.
Hal's amazing, and he says that as a joke, but it's actually true. I just was flexible. So we had a speaker who begged and begged, and it was a woman. Just, you know, again, one of our women is the one who dropped out, and she just dropped out. She just didn't even show up. We're on a cruise. And she doesn't show up for her talk. You know, we knew she was on the boat. There wasn't much else she could be doing. But so I was like, oh, okay. So I just moved things around. And that was fine. Everything went well there. What I did wrong was I did not have enough communication with the speakers. I wasn't there as a support organ for them, and I should have been. I should have sent every speaker. And when I'm saying I, translate that to mean the event organizing staff.
Yeah.
Should send every speaker a guide. Here's what will happen. Here's what you need. Here are some helpful tips to, that type of thing. When Randy spoke at TED in 2007, they sent a plaque, and it was the TED Commandments. Get it? The TED Commandments.
Yes.
Anyway. And it was it was very useful things. Thou shalt not overrun your time. Thou shalt not, that kind of thing. And I failed to do that on this cruise because I thought, oh, everyone knows how to talk in front of an audience. Well, it's not true. Some of these people are doing it for the very first time. So giving them some sort of guide and making contact with them just before the event and saying, hey, you're on tomorrow. Is everything cool? You need anything? That kind of thing. That would have been really helpful. So that's all I have.
I have something. On that. I forgot to mention something that we did very well. Taylor Proctor put together guidelines for speakers that she sent out to everybody. Those were really useful. That just basically had very similar stuff, right? Stay on time. This is how it's going to work. This is how much time you have. We will kick you out after X amount of minutes. But she also did this thing that called Skepta Boot Camp, which was a series of presentations or a series of meetings leading up to Skepta Camp on various topics about how to speak. So there were things like how to put together a good PowerPoint presentation, how to speak in front of a crowd, very basic things. And we had different people in Atlanta helping with those. And they were a huge success. Just even things like we started out, the very first one she did was how to come up with a topic. What do you want to talk about? How to solidify that and come up with an outline for what you want to do. That was a really, really good thing that we did. Because a big part of Skepta Camp for us was we wanted to attract people who had never who potentially had never spoken in front of people before, and make them feel comfortable and make them feel like they knew what they were doing so they could practice with people, they could get some tips on how to use PowerPoint and how to speak and all those types of things.
Maria, who was it that led that effort?
Taylor Proctor.
Oh, okay. So their lead organizer, or Taylor's a lead organizer, she led the Skepta Boot Camp as well.
Correct. Well, all she did, she didn't actually... She didn't actually run the individual sessions. She organized them and got people to help out, right? So, for example, Tim Farley did the one on PowerPoint. Swoopy did the one on presenting to people. And she had a couple of other people who led the actual sessions. She just kind of coordinated them and found a venue and so on.
How many people did you have go through boot camp?
Fortune cookie.
We didn't.
What are we laughing at?
Come on, everybody, at Rich's fortune cookie.
Now, kids.
Keep going.
We didn't have a ton. I think we had maybe 4 or 5 at the max in the different sessions. But I think it was plenty in terms of it gave, you know, and I think different people came to different sessions. But I think it gave the kind of newbie people who needed that kind of attention some help and confidence in terms of getting them comfortable with speaking in front of people.
We actually did a Skepta Boot Camp as well when we heard about that one, and it was put together really last minute. But we had a couple people take advantage of it, and one of our organizers, Graham Kennedy, ran all of them out of his house. And I think because it was so last minute, we, you know, most of the speakers were already prepared, but we're definitely going to try it again next year. It did seem to be a good idea.
What do you think they got most out of it?
I think it was just confidence. You know, some of the people they weren't really experienced speakers, and, you know, just getting to do like a trial run or, you know, just an opportunity to, you know, just have somebody give some feedback on their talk, that kind of thing, help them, you know, get some confidence to go up.
One thing I'd like to say is that one of the things that we did with Skepta Camp is we had somebody who was a dedicated MC and person who was responsible for basically kind of like running around and making sure that the speakers were ready the day of. That was my job. And I think that kind of helped things go a lot more smoothly because, you know, sometimes it gets busy and speakers lose track of time or whatever. So, and you know, kind of going in and saying, okay, you know that you're talking in 10 minutes, and do you have everything? Are you ready? I think that you know, the day of, as Jeff was saying, you know, flexibility, that kind of tweaking, if you will, in real time can really help in some cases, you know, to make sure. Because there was one case where I think we actually had to swap a talk, I believe, if I remember correctly. I'm not sure. I've been drinking, so.
What?
Yeah, I mean,
you're drinking.
I think
you're such a disappointment.
Rich Orman, did we have to swap around any talks because speakers weren't ready?
Yes.
What exactly happened there?
Thanks for sharing.
Speakers weren't ready, so we swapped talks. And I think that's a valuable thing. It's also a valuable thing to have that other room available for. But I think really an important thing is to have a hard time limit and to keep people on it. That way you can have a lot of speaking slots. We learned the hard way a couple years ago where we allowed people to take up to an hour. And that was just a disaster. Total disaster.
Yeah, we had some talks that caused people to become in the audience become antsy, and some of them left after a talk was particularly abusive in terms of being long and boring. And I think it might have been
yes,
my talk.
Yes, especially the guy that talked about love for a whole hour.
Oh yeah,
you had someone talk about love for an hour? Can you do
yeah,
that?
Yeah, an hour, and he talked about love, and it was just. I mean, I was the MC, and I just left the room, and I just said, okay, I got about another half hour. I'll be back, guys, and just left, and I came back, and people were very agitated.
As far as talk lengths go, that might be the exception. Did anybody else allow talks that were an hour long?
No.
Hell no.
I think that 25 minutes it should be the limit.
We didn't have some speakers. Go ahead and talk.
Ours were 20 with like, I think we gave them a total of 25, and they could break it up however we wanted, but we recommended 20 and 5 for questions.
We did something similar. I think it was 20 or 25 minutes.
And I was this last year I was a little bit more lenient and we went way late. This year I was really, really mean. I was like, get out. You're done. We actually had a decent turnout. I think we had about 40 to 50% women, two brown girls. So I think we win in the diversity category. But obviously that was nowhere near enough. But yeah, we have a fairly diverse group. We have a pretty young. Our crowd skews pretty young, and it does skew pretty much 50-50 in terms of men and women. So we've been fairly lucky, and we have a lot of loud women who are perfectly happy to speak. But again, it is only about 40 to 50% still.
How about older speakers? Did anybody have any older or either senior citizens or anybody else like that speak?
Well, we had Matt Young.
We had Matt Young from the Panda's Thumb blog come and talk, and
Brian,
he is probably 70.
I IMC'd, and I'm an old guy, so never mind. Go. The joke's gone.
We had
a really big range in our March one.
We did have a scientist from Fermilab, right, Elise? I can't remember her name. Susan. Gosh, what was Susan's last name? She was a replacement speaker for us, and she was older, and she was very, very well received, and that was actually very exciting. In my opinion, it was one of the best talks, but I'm a physics geek, so I'm biased. But so we did have kind of a range. We had a couple of younger speakers. We had a good number of middle-aged speakers, but then we had her as well, which was kind of nice. It was kind of nice to see that diversity.
Yeah, one of my ongoing questions is how we can integrate the first generation of skepticism into these open events, and we've only had mixed success in Colorado with that.
We had a guy show up late, and we he wasn't scheduled to talk, but we kind of gave him time, and we made time for him in the middle of the first speaker. And he's 95 now, you know, white beard, little guy, and he was pretty cool. He only spoke for, you know, maybe 10 minutes and then had to leave for an event, but but that was interesting.
Yes,
Brian's talking about James Randi.
That's one of the DC good things. Yeah.
It was just one of those things. Chip Denman, they were all in town because of another event, and he kind of brought them by as a surprise. There's no way we're going to be able to live that down. Every other event we're going to have is going to be lame because our first one happened to have Randi. So.
Brian, you'll have to get the Satanist speaker
already.
Back.
Brian, was that at all? I know it was. I mean, I was very cool, but was that at all intimidating to the speakers?
Actually, they.
I always am a little leery about having kind of big names at Skepticamp.
Well,
because some of these people have never spoken before, and if you're on stage, if you got to follow James Randi, that's going to be a little intimidating.
Well, our first speaker was Anthony. He was a college student. He was with the college student group. He's the guy who gave us the venue. And his talk was like a YouTube discussion. And we had to interrupt him in the middle because Randi had to leave. And he did his little, like, 10-minute talk. And then he continued discussion after. He actually handled it very well. I was a little worried at first when I first heard they were coming because I remember maybe it was Elise that mentioned that maybe PZ wanted to talk at your skeptic camp. And you had to turn him down because you were worried about it intimidating other speakers. And I told Chip up front, I was like, I know you guys, and I know that it's going to be kind of cool, and I know that the college students are going to be, like, crazy to see and shake Randi's hand, but I'm worried about this. And actually, it worked out very, very well. And after, I mean, because his posse, if you want to call it that, DJ and Jamie and Swiss and all of them were all there, they all left after the first talk. I mean, Jamie stayed a little bit longer, and he actually commented on a few things because mm-hmm. he had some interest in the YouTube discussion. But they didn't stay very long, and then after the day went on, especially because we started out with a discussion, everyone was kind of in that mood to just talk, and I think it went very, very well, and the speakers weren't intimidated. We had a lot of audience interaction. I'm very happy. So,
Jim, did you have a point to make for the older speakers?
I just wanted to mention that we had two University of Manitoba professors, one of whom was older, and he's the director of the Center for Applied Ethics, I think, Professor Arthur Schaefer, and he was great. Most of our presenters were younger, but we had people who ranged from 20 to, you know, probably 60-ish. So it was pretty good.
Good. We're down to about 13 minutes left. I wanted to open the floor to questions.
Nobody ever asked about DC.
I've been talking the whole time.
I know that, but okay. I had something I wanted to bring up.
Oh,
and
okay.
Go ahead and bring it up. This is the time to bring it up.
So, one of the things that Brian and I talked about before this was that one of the things we did wrong was that we didn't start, well, it's sort of twofold. We didn't start our publicity push early enough because we really didn't start sort of publicizing our Skepticamp until sort of late August, September. I know we got some podcast mentions, and I wrote like a publicity blurb that some people were supposed to put out somewhere. I don't know if that ever we ever managed to get that published in some of the local papers.
I don't think it did.
Yeah, I don't think it did either. So if people were going to, you know, try and get something published sort of in the local community papers in like Baltimore and the D.C. area. And then I think we also neglected our wiki, Skepticamp wiki, and also we had a D.C., Skepticamp D.C. page, which it would have been nice if we had sort of publicized like the speakers ahead of time, because I think there was some confusion up towards, you know, the last couple of weeks. It's like, who's speaking? Are you speaking? I don't know if I made the schedule. So, like, only a couple of people actually knew the schedule, because I didn't know until, like, 2 weeks before. I'm like, oh, okay, I really have to get this, you know, talk together.
Tana, were you guys having regular meetings up until the event, or were they were? Okay.
Well, our last meeting was at least a month, or actually almost a month and a half out. And then we did everything else on the email list. Also, because we had a lot of college students involved, because we were looking at the event starting the first week in October, we actually were going to try to do it in September. But their school year just started. So trying to get them to organize anything before the school year started was pretty much impossible because they're not there. So it was kind of a complicating factor.
Regarding promotion, anybody else have any big wins or problems that they notice?
You know, we didn't get a ton of publicity or anything like that. Although I did, I publish, you know, and anything online that was like local Atlanta that I could find, like we have Access Atlanta and things like that. I went ahead and posted information. But for some reason, and this happened both years, we got a ton of new people who showed up, and I'm really not sure why. You know, didn't really do anything different, but we did have we had people who drove in from other states this past year. So I guess Meetup is pretty good, but, you know, people do a lot. I mean, people find us a lot through Meetup, so that might be it, but... But yeah, I mean, we've had a lot of. I mean, Skepticamp has always expanded our group for whatever reason.
Yeah,
we have a question from Jamie Williams in chat. What organizations did you ask for funding from, and which ones gave it, and why or why did you not ask for funding?
Big fundraiser.
Delay, sorry.
Go on, Elise.
We had a fundraiser party, and, you know, we raised a lot of money through that. We asked for funding from... we actually had a girl who actually did all the funding, you know, requests, and she sent out probably 50 emails, and we got support from... Skeptical Inquirer and Surly Ramix gave us some money too, and then Amy from Surly Ramix came and she actually had a table at Skeptica Camp and she sold Surly's there and she gave us a portion of that. So that was really awesome.
We also had an auction.
Elise, what did you spend the money on?
What did we spend the money on? Chicago, it turns out, is not a cheap place to have a free event. There are very few places willing to give free space, and we actually weren't able to find any. And sales tax is 10%. So. It was really expensive just to hold the event, and we put the money towards that, and then we actually raised so much money that we were required to form a nonprofit organization in Illinois. So otherwise we were going to get, you know, arrested.
Yeah, that's what we're working on right now.
And that's what we're working on now.
Yeah. Something I don't know if you guys caught it earlier, but something else that we did as far as raising money is we had an auction, right, Elise? I can't remember. We did at the fundraising. We had a fundraising party, and at the fundraising party, we auctioned off some things too. And I believe we also did some stuff on eBay. Is that right, Elise?
We did some stuff on eBay. Yeah.
Right. Yeah. So, and we also got we went around to. People that we knew in the skeptical community, we kind of, you know, asked for donations and whatnot. We got a fair number of people locally donating money to get this thing kickstarted too.
Yeah, it turns out skeptics really want to fund skeptic stuff. So if you ask, they will help you fund your thing. I mean, it was really amazing how. I mean, I've been doing skeptic on a budget of like $400, and after. I think a week of fundraising, we had exceeded that.
Yeah, I remember when Lisa and I were at the fundraising party, we were wowed by how much money we raised.
Yeah, Richard, want to say something?
Yeah, we actually went for no funding. We took the Reed Esau model, no money. It worked out pretty well, actually. Part of it was we didn't want to tie ourselves to an organization. We were actually a little leery about taking CFI's space because we didn't associate with anyone. We took it. They were gracious about that.
I'm sorry. What were the concerns about being associated with a group?
Perception in the public.
Okay.
Yeah,
there's a delay on your
of
link,
the public seeing certain expectations. Yeah, there's a delay.
Yeah, well, let's put the organization question aside because that was a fairly big one. But we had one more question from the chat room. What is your advice for first time organizers? And we want to hear from others who, I guess, ideally those who have just had their first time event. Jim.
So. The thing that I found most helpful was getting sort of the organization team, having them meet a couple of months before the event and just do some really loose planning. And then a month and a half beforehand, what we did is we had an organizing party and we helped each other with ideas for talks. We talked about basically everything on the big list. And we kept the lines of communication open. We had an email list, and we talked back and forth, and everybody was very helpful and open. It helped that we, although it was sort of an independent event, the Winnipeg Skeptic Camp was organized by the Winnipeg Skeptics, that's my group, and also by the several members of the Humanist Association of Manitoba, And so people tended to know each other fairly well already, for the most part. So communication was definitely our friend.
I mean, Brian?
We took a similar approach. I mean, first off, it's about a year ago, I started socializing the idea, and it was prompted by Melody Hensley, who is the administrator for CFI in D.C. But she's like, we ought to do a skeptic camp. And I was like, well, I've been thinking about it. Thanks for kicking me in the ass. I'll start socializing the idea. So I started going to all the groups that meet in the area and just socializing the idea, and then I just scheduled the first meeting. And whoever showed up, they got a job. And I just, I mean, when you take people and you kind of expect something of them, or you give them responsibility, they either step up or they don't. And the ones who step up, you keep them. And the ones that don't, you say, well, maybe you can help some other way. And then you find someone else for that job. And it just happens that we had a lot of people that wanted to do something and thought it was a great idea, and we had meetings. We had a couple of regular meetings every month for a while. And the people who showed up, they worked, and we pulled it off. We actually didn't have to do that much work because we had so many people to delegate to, and everyone had their little piece and felt
let's go
ownership. So
let's go to Maria. Maria, first time advice for first-time organizers. You have 45 seconds.
Bathroom breaks. Make sure you schedule bathroom breaks. I forgot that the first year. Oops. Seriously, I think the one piece of advice I can give you is I am like the overplanner. That's what I do, and you can't overplan Skepticamp. So all you can do is put together a structure, and then you kind of just have to step back and let it be a little bit organic, and just sort of jump in and be flexible and make changes on the fly.
Okay, Elise, advice for first-time organizers.
50 seconds.
My advice is to just do it, and you know, put your best effort into it. You cannot know what you're going to expect. You know, Reed has a really great kind of outline of what to do and what to expect, and adhere to that as much as you can, and break it when you need to. And then move on from that. I mean, it's really, you have to go with the flow. You have to just, because you're not. You're going to think that you have it all figured out, and then everything's going to change.
Yeah, I just like to say.
Rich Orman, you get the last word.
And he muted himself. Oh,
go
no.
Go to Reed's Wiki and follow it to the letter.
And Matt?
Yeah,
It's counting up now.
Yeah, okay. I would just say that
we've launched.
I would reiterate. I would reiterate a lot of what was already said in terms of, you know, you got to make sure you have a core group of people that meet regularly, and a lot of the people that got Skeptic Camp together, we did not know each other before we started meeting, and we've since become.
And now we're
really
like BFFs.
Friends. Yeah, we're like, yeah, bitch. What do you want to do tonight? You know, so. But my point is, by socializing together like that, we really raised the expectation level, and we made sure that we were getting our shit done, because you know it, you know, when you're meeting with these people twice a month.
And they're not just your, you know, they're not just these people that you're getting together with; they're your friends, and you don't want to let them down. And
yeah, so.
Well, on that positive note, Brian, the floor to you to introduce the next virtual drinking skeptically event.
Oh, we have one next week, next Friday. Ben Radford's going to be on here. We're going to be asking him questions and hanging out with him and being silly. So it should be a lot of fun.
Cool.
Unlike this, where we're hanging out and being so serious. Seriously, people, lighten up.
Hey, I'm trying.
Thank you, everybody, for participating. I think this is a great, great first post-mortem.
Thanks once again to all the participants of the first virtual postmortem for Skepticamp. If you have any questions about Skepticamp, please go to skepticamp.org. Thanks.